You're joining us here on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city for Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. This is the 105th episode of Evening Under Lamplight, so we can announce we're 105 on Cambridge 105. Greg likes that too. We're talking this evening about outcasts, those whom respectable people turn their backs to and exclude from the social center. Many of us think at this time of year of the homeless, sleeping rough on the cold streets, and these brothers and sisters certainly are outcasts. And so are many others whom we might overlook or might justify ourselves for overlooking. Well, we'll try this evening under lamplight not to overlook them, but to look them over and extend a hand. Now, there's going to be a short extract from a play coming to Cambridge next week about sex trafficking. I should warn you here at the start that this extract contains what's called adult content. We shouldn't turn away from this sort of thing, but we have to be aware that it is disturbing. Now first, as a sort of text with which we introduce our theme, let's have our taste of Whitman. We're up to the 19th section, or chant, of Song of Myself, coming to the end of what has been called the third sequence in this long poem, a section where Whitman has brought before us a broad range of Americans, sometimes in vivid sketches, sometimes in just a few short phrases, men, women, animals, as they go about their everyday life. Whitman observes them and invites us to observe them too without judgment. But I think he goes further. He merges with them. He sees that these people are no different from himself. They might as well be other manifestations of the same large soul or spirit that he recognizes in himself, what Emerson called the oversoul. Watch how, in the 16 lines of this final chant of the sequence, Whitman welcomes the outcasts and merges himself with them, almost in a sexual merging. This is the meal pleasantly set. This is the meat and drink for natural hunger. It is for the wicked just the same as the righteous. I make appointments with all. I will not have a single person slighted or left away. The kept woman and sponger and thief are hereby invited. The heavy-lipped slave is invited. The venereal lee is invited. There shall be no difference between them and the rest. This is the press of the bashful hand. This is the float and odor of hair. This is the touch of my lips to yours. This is the murmur of yearning. This is the far-off depth and height reflecting my own face. This is the thoughtful merge of myself and the outlet again. Do you guess I have some intricate purpose? Well, I have. For the April rain has, and the mica on the side of a rock has. Do you take it I would astonish? Does the daylight astonish, or the early red star twittering through the woods? Do I astonish more than they? This hour I tell things in confidence. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you, indeed. Well, what is he telling us? This is the meal pleasantly set. What is the meal? Perhaps we can take it that the whole poem before us is a meal, a poem for us to take pleasure in, but also to read, mark, and inwardly digest. An experience that nourishes us. A meal is also a communal affair. I remember one of my professors saying, in his humble and wise way, "It is a mistake to think that we ever read anything entirely for or by ourselves." That is, every act of reading is a community affair. We read the work in the company of all others who have read the book, although we may never know them. And if the piece has been shown so far to no one but you, well, there is still the company of you and the writer, a small but valid community. This is, Whitman says, the meat and drink for natural hunger. Well, it's not for natural hunger in the sense of the physical hunger in the belly. We're not invited to eat the poem literally. Do you remember the story about Flannery O'Connor, the writer of those exquisite Southern Gothic stories, often, in fact, about outcasts? Too funny for me to read on air because I'd just laugh, but also very gruesome and often violent. A friend of Flannery's mother once told her that one of her stories left a bad taste in my mouth. "You weren't supposed to eat it," Flannery replied. No, the natural hunger, then, isn't physical hunger. But I think it might be that hunger that is natural to all of us. The hunger for community, for delight, for a sense of higher meaning in life and a connection to that higher meaning. In one sense, no matter how rich or comfortable we are, if we are living in a self-directed world, and we all are to some degree, we are starving in a wasteland, hungry for some nourishment to fill the depths of our nature. Throughout the poem, Whitman has been directing us and inviting us to share the joyful vision he experienced, which feeds this natural hunger. And here we are, at the great feast, to which everyone is invited. The wicked just the same as the righteous. No one is judged here, just accepted. That's the pattern we've been seeing all along in Whitman. People in the wasteland judge. They have to assess whether someone is one of us and therefore acceptable, or some other to be rejected and cast out. But at this feast, Whitman knows he is connected at a deep level to everyone, no matter what they've done or who they are, wicked or righteous. And he gives us a small catalogue of outcasts who are welcome to the meal. The final catalogue in this sequence that has contained so many long catalogues. Here we have, then, the kept woman and sponger and thief. The disreputable woman who provides sex for a man in exchange for money and a place to live, ensuring that she is scorned by respectable people. There's the sponger, too, that guy who never seems to have a job or any money, who shows up at the pub waiting for someone else to buy a round, who borrows money with no intention of paying it back. You know the type. Often very charming, but one of those people you don't want to have around. Too bad. If you want part of Whitman's meal, you have to accept the sponger there, too, and accept that this sponger is welcomed just as warmly as you are. There shall be no difference, Whitman says, between them and the rest. The same goes for the thief, and not just the punk who steals your phone from your side pocket or breaks into your house, but also the rich guys stealing the money and jobs and hopes of the poor. The rich cast out the poor like Lazarus and the beggar, but the poor also cast out the rich and comfort themselves by despising the affluent as rich scum, and yet both are invited to the feast with no difference between them. No difference either between the slave, who counted as 3/5 of a man in Whitman's days. No difference between the slave and anyone else at this table. And the venereally, as Whitman puts it, the person with VD. Ew, get that scum away from me. And of course, it's not just VD. Someone with AIDS, or Ebola, or as the case might be now, alas, some kid not vaccinated against measles. Keep that kid away from my children. No, Whitman says. The venereally is invited. Whitman doesn't hold on to an image for long, and he drops the meal imagery in favor of a more intimate sexual image, illustrating the way we might come closer and yet closer to some other. First, there is the press of a bashful hand. Whose hand? Mine or the other's? Well, it doesn't matter. Then we get closer, close enough to smell the other person's hair, the float and odor of hair. I like that float. Is this some kind of shampoo or conditioner commercial? where we see the girl's fluffy hair dancing out everywhere as she coyly tosses her head? No, I doubt it. Whitman's not playing with us that way. Let's just appreciate the understated way he puts it. Just float and odor of the hair, leaving us to develop the image further ourselves. The erotic image. Remember, this is an image trying to explain what it feels like to come closer to anyone, not necessarily a lover. The image gets more intimate with the touch of my lips to yours and the murmur of yearning. And as I get closer, I can perceive within you the far-off depth and height reflecting my own face. That is, once I let myself get close enough, I can see myself within you. We are one, both human beings with the same nature, both players in the same game. This, Whitman concludes, is the thoughtful merge of myself and the outlet again. I merge with you, I become you, but there's also the outlet again, allowing me to be myself and you yourself. Back and forth, merging together, returning from the merge, always a knit of identity, as Whitman had said earlier in the poem, always distinction. Then Whitman himself breaks the merge between him and us to speak to us directly. He's aware that his erotic imagery was highly charged. What's he trying to do to us? Do you guess I have some intricate purpose, he asks, and then answers, well, I have. Now he's no longer the prophet or sage, but a kind of seducer, trying to lead us on. But, he says, his aim is no more than that of the April rain, or the mica on the side of a rock, those little white bits gleaming in the sunlight, or the daylight, or the early red start, it's a bird, the early red start bird twittering through the woods. All these natural features have the same intricate purpose. Not to manipulate us or control us, but simply to astonish us so that we can wake up to the vision. Bob Dylan has recently declared that his vocation at all times has been just confounding expectations. What do you do for a living, man? Oh, I confound expectations. Well, Whitman's doing that too. And finally, he ends this chant by becoming our buddy, imparting his secret wisdom. If we've come this far and allowed ourselves to be astonished, then he can tell us his secret. This hour I tell things in confidence. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you. What is he telling us? Well, we have to wait for the next long sequence to find out. Wait and see. We've spent a long time with Whitman this week, and I'll just read the passage again so we can attend more carefully after our discussion. Then we'll move on to what's next. This is the meal pleasantly set. This is the meat and drink for natural hunger. It is for the wicked just the same as the righteous. I make appointments with all. I will not have a single person slighted or left away. The kept woman and sponger and thief are hereby invited. The heavy-lipped slave is invited. The venereolee is invited. There shall be no difference between them and the rest. This is the press of a bashful hand. This is the float and odor of hair. This is the touch of my lips to yours. This is the murmur of yearning. This is the far-off depth and height reflecting my own face. This is the thoughtful merge of myself and the outlet again. Do you guess I have some intricate purpose? Well, I have. For the April rain has, and the mica on the side of a rock has. Do you take it I would astonish? Does the daylight astonish? Or the early red star twittering through the woods? Do I astonish more than they? This hour I tell things in confidence. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
George Harrison, like Walt Whitman, wants to tell us something, but what he wants to tell us is just from his head. My head is filled with things to say. And thus, when he gets near us and gets caught in all the games, he seems to act unkind, and he feels hung up and doesn't know why. But he can wait forever. I've got time. Whitman had time, too. We've spent a long time with Whitman, and it got a little heavy. Let me tell you, there are more heavy things coming along, so let's lighten things a bit while staying on our theme of outcasts. When A.B. in Liverpool heard that the theme of the show was to be outcasts, he immediately suggested G. Officer Krupke from West Side Story. And why not? We should always dose ourselves in some Leonard Bernstein now and then. And Stephen Sondheim, who wrote the lyrics. In fact, West Side Story was Sondheim's Broadway debut. In the context of Whitman's poem, we can see this song as an attempt to deal with an outcast kid on the street whom everyone just wants to get rid of, or to pass on to someone else to get rid of, as it turns out. Sondheim takes the kid through a series of dialogues with authority figures who are supposed to know how to deal with these outcasts. First, with Sergeant Krupke, the cop on the beat, who's ready to bring the kid in, but the kid pleads that it's just his bringing up key that gets him out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks. They're all just misunderstood delinquents, but basically good deep down. Whitman would agree, I suppose, but not Sergeant Krupke, who sends the kid to the judge in the juvenile court. Again, the kid uses the excuse of a dysfunctional family. Parents who won't even give him some of the marijuana they smoke all the time. And the judge buys the sorry tale. The kid's not bad. It's just his neurosis that ought to be curbed. He's psychologically disturbed. This kid is depraved on account he ain't had a normal home. Hey, says the smart-ass kid, I'm depraved on account I'm deprived. So pass him on to someone else. The head shrinker. So the kid goes to the shrink, and again blames his problems on his family. They're all weird and deviant. Goodness gracious, that's why I'm a mess. It's not a psychological problem at all, the psychiatrist says. Society's played him a terrible trick, and sociologically he's sick. Juvenile delinquency is purely a social disease. Hey, the kid quips, I've got a social disease. The joke there is that social disease was a euphemism for VD. So now we're back to the venereal Lee, aren't we? So pass him over to the social worker, where the kid confesses his own role in the problem. They say go earn some dough, like be a soda jerker, which means like be a schmo. That, anyway, is the polite version they used on stage. But the original is more earthy. They say go earn a buck, like be a soda jerker, which means like be a schmuck. They must have felt that even that Yiddish word schmuck was too strong for Broadway ears. But here's the point. It's not I'm anti-social, I'm only anti-work. Glorioski, that's why I'm a jerk. And that's enough. The social worker doesn't want any more of this runaround. She grabs his one small admission, declares that deep down inside him he's no good, and passes him off to spend a year in the pen. And that's it. No one wants a fella with a social disease. Cast this fella out. Or invite him to Whitman's meal pleasantly set. Sometimes, listening to the song, I tune out the words and just attend to Bernstein's music, the mocking brass and the syncopations. Attend now as you choose.
Kindly Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
G. Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us there is good.
There is good.
There is good, there is good, there is untapped good. Like inside the voice of us is good.
That's a touching good story.
Let me tell it to the world.
Just tell it to the judge.
Hey, the judge.
Come on,
you. Dear kindly judge, your honor, my parents treat me rough. With all the marijuana, they won't give me a puff. They didn't want to have me, but somehow I was had. Leaping lizards, that's why I'm so bad.
Right, Officer Krupke, you're really a square. This boy don't need a judge, he needs an analyst's care. It's just his neurosis that ought to be curbed. He's psychologically disturbed.
I'm disturbed.
We're disturbed. We're the most disturbed. Like we're psychologically disturbed.
Hear ye, in the opinion of this court, this child is depraved on account of he ain't had a normal home.
Hey, I'm depraved on account I'm deprived.
So take him to a head shrinker.
Come on, let's go.
My father is a bastard. My ma's an SOB. My grandpa's always plastered. My grandma pushes tea. My sister wears a mustache. My brother wears a dress. Goodness gracious, that's why I'm a mess.
Yes, Officer Krupke, you're really a slob. This boy don't need a doctor, just a good honest job. Society's played him a terrible trick. And sociologically, he's sick.
I am sick.
We are sick. We are sick, sick, sick. Like we're sociologically sick.
In my opinion, this child does not need to have his head shrunk at all. Juvenile delinquency is purely a social disease.
Hey, I got a social disease.
So take him to a social worker.
Dear kindly social worker, they say go earn some dough. Like be a soda jerker, which means like be a schmo. It's not I'm anti-social, I'm only anti-work. Glory Oski, that's why I'm a jerk.
Hey, Officer Krupke, you've done it again. This boy don't need a job, he needs a year in the pen. It ain't just a question of misunderstood. Deep down inside him, he's no good.
I'm no good.
We're no good.
The trouble is he drinks.
The trouble is he's crazy.
The trouble is he stinks.
The trouble is he's growing.
The trouble is he's grown.
Krupke, we got troubles of our own. Gee, Officer Krupke, we're down on our knees. Cause no one wants a fellow with a social disease. Gee, Officer Krupke, what are we to do? Gee, Officer Krupke.
G. Officer Krupke, Krupp you. What does Krupp you mean? Nothing. Or at least nothing officially. Its meaning comes from how we interpret it from the context. It's one of those expressions created for the script of West Side Story to give the kids a street language that would be credible but not too offensive and not liable to become dated. But you're never dated if you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Walt Whitman has led us this evening into considering the topic of outcasts. Our next segment is something unusual. On the one hand, it is a coming events announcement. On the other, it is a mini performance, a preview of this upcoming event. What is the event? It is a performance of Asina, a one-woman show coming to Cambridge on Thursday the 19th of February at the Round Church at 7:30 p.m. This is an intense drama opening to us the horrors of sex trafficking. Genevieve Cleghorn plays Asina, a young woman lured to England from Albania, expecting to get married, but imprisoned in a grimy house in North London, surrounded by ruthless thugs using her, not even for their own pleasure, but as a commodity to make money from. But she isn't a commodity, and her one-hour monologue gives us the view into that humanity, and thus we feel the pain that she feels. The character of Asina comes alive. We see her wretched life. She's an outcast, a piece of meat to the men who run this show. Can we invite her to Whitman's meal pleasantly set? Would we even know how to? And what about her oppressors? Can we bring ourselves to invite them too? And if not, aren't we being a little hypocritical? It's tough, isn't it, to work this all out? Genevieve came into the studio the other day and recorded a few minutes of the show, depicting what happened to Asina on her arrival in London. Here's the second alert to disturbing material about to come your way. This is pretty harrowing, but attend if you can.
My first views of Britain are through tired eyes staring out of hire car window. Green fields flashing by and long, wide roads full of traffic. We arrive in London, outside of an ugly terrace house. Abu tells me this is where we will be staying and we get out. He knocks at the door and this fat man in a brown overcoat answers. Abu says this is his friend Jerry who will look after me while he goes and arranges things for our wedding the next day. I walk into the house. Abu does not kiss me goodbye. I remember this later. We stand in a corridor of open doors, the rooms in darkness. The house smells of dirt and dogs. Dogs barking and growling at the sound of us. Claws scratching against the closed door somewhere beyond the passage. Jerry turns around to me. I remember smiling at him, about to mention that I had left my handbag in the car. I say nothing, because he hit me in the stomach and pushed me into one of the rooms, closing the door behind me. There are many hands on me, and I fight and scream, but it does not stop them tearing off my clothes. Does not stop the gang rape. That is other expression I have since learned. They pushed me down onto a mattress on the floor, then they abuse me, one after the other. I still fight. I miss myself. The men laugh at this. It does not stop them assaulting me. The door opens and shuts. Men come in and others go out until my struggling stops. My strength gone. Exhausted, I become a lump of flesh. I feel my blood bleed out from between my legs. The dogs bark. My mind closes, and I pass out to sleep my first night in England.
We couldn't just jump from Asina back to the studio. We needed some music to help us through, and that was the opening of Bruch's Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre is a prayer, or more properly speaking, a declaration, at the start of the Yom Kippur service, the holiest moment in the Jewish calendar, which begins the acts of purification at the start of the new year. Before the Kol Nidre, the following legal announcement is made. By the authority of the court on high, and by authority of the court down here, by the permission of one who is everywhere, and by the permission of this congregation, We hold it lawful to pray with sinners. You know where we are now, don't you? At Whitman's table for the wicked, just the same as the righteous. No outcasts here. But after Genevieve spoke these lines from the play, I let her and Stephen Lovelace, her colleague at Arcadia Rain Limited, talk more about the play and its creation. Here's what they were saying. So where did the idea come from for doing this play?
In the waiting room of Loughborough train station where we were filming two films back to back. And we were talking between shots and discussing a short film initially and looking at what would be a possible idea. And then Genevieve suddenly came through with this story about trafficking. And I suspect that's really where it all began.
Yeah, I'd actually somehow got onto the mailing list of Stop the Traffic. So because of that, I had regular email updates through. So obviously it was an issue that I was aware of. And that was how it came about.
Prior to that, we had been talking about doing a one-woman drama, so the two came together.
And then you both wrote it together?
Well, we worked on it together. I initially wrote it. The first few lines was actually a history of Asana as a teenager, and that was written on the cliffs on the way to Whitby, Scarborough, in the March. And then we worked on it together through 3 months?
Yeah, we worked on it in terms of all the research and obviously developing the character and then workshops to develop scenarios. But once we'd done all of that and I'd written diary entries and character as a center and that sort of thing, but Stephen was the one who actually wrote the script, so he is the writer.
Well, there was lots of work coming in and much learnt from the workshop, some of which were 9 hours long.
Workshops, just the two of you?
Just the two of us, yeah. Genevieve staying in character for up to 9 hours, and I play the other characters, which I mentioned.
And how do you survive this, Genevieve?
Well, obviously, you know, because it is such a, you know, such a gritty subject matter, and I wanted to do it justice. But certainly, you know, during that period and for quite a long time afterwards, I really wasn't able to watch much other than romantic comedies in terms of going to the cinema, because I just couldn't take anything that was intense or heavy because of this world that I was looking into and that I had to portray on stage and obviously now on radio as well. But one of the things that was very important to us in the rehearsal process, and certainly when we do the performance now, is actually the ability to just snap in and out of character very, very quickly, so you're not actually carrying it around with you. And we also had lots of breaks and scones and things.
Oh, well, I was going to say, there was lots of cream teas and going and doing something quite daft afterwards.
To just try and lighten what we were doing.
Part of that really was for Genevieve to stay in accent. And we'd also actually go out for a day, such as Coventry, and she would be a Senna, going into the shops, and she'd stay in accent, and did get caught out in Trinity Church in Coventry, where the person asked where you came from, and they didn't know anything about Albania, and they took you away for you to tell them all about Albania. So
that's right, and you got them to sign some sort of certificate to say, we think she's real.
Exactly. No, I should have done that.
But we did have an Albanian come to see it in London that said Genevieve had got the accent spot on.
Oh, great. That's wonderful. So then you've got two performances in Cambridge coming up. You've done some before at Christ's... what was that called?
This will be our sixth performance in Cambridge.
And where did I see it? That was at the...
The Corpus Playroom.
Corpus Playroom, yes.
And that was 2 years ago now.
Yes, we played Bedford first. And we played London a few times in different venues and Huntingdon, but it's the sixth time played somewhere in Cambridge, and then it'll be the seventh on the 12th.
Yeah, and this is the second time at the Round Church, but this time we're working with Christian Heritage, so tickets can be bought through their website, and that's on Thursday the 19th of February.
And then on
at what time? You've got to see the time.
I think it's 7:30 p.m. Yeah.
Okay. Thursday, the 12th of February. That's in 2 days' time from Broadcasting Day at the Round Church in Cambridge, and you can buy your tickets in advance or just show up at the door. And I don't know what they cost, but it's not going to break your bank
no,
at all.
No, tickets are £5, so that's hopefully definitely shouldn't break the bank.
That's right. And the profits go to somebody else. Genevieve, I'm sure, gets nothing for this because you're doing this from love. Commitment, service, I don't know.
Well, no, it's going to be a 50-50 box office split.
Oh, good, so we get 250.
It's been a labour of love, like, for 3 years, and we have no funding as a limited company.
What's the name of your company? We haven't said that.
Yeah, Arcadia Rain, and we have a website as well, www.arcadiarain.com. And on the news page, you will see details of the upcoming performances that we have, because we're also doing it with Amnesty International on Thursday, the 12th of March.
In Cambridge?
In Cambridge as well, yeah.
Not at the Round Church this time?
Not at the Round Church. That's going to be at the Friends Meeting House.
Great.
And we'll be posting details shortly of how tickets can be obtained for that as well.
It's part of International Women's Day.
I'd say, as it should be. Yes, you can go around the world and do it on these special days.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. And this is Genevieve Cleghorn and Stephen Lovelace with their show Arsino, and I hope you come and see it, and I'll see you there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was my discussion with Genevieve Cleghorn and Stephen Lovelace, the two movers or machers behind Arcadia Rain Limited. That's Arcadia Rain, R-E-I-G-N, and at .com, and you're there on their site. You may have noticed a mistake I made in the discussion. The performance of Arsina at the Round Church is not, I repeat, not on 12 February, but on 19 February. That is Thursday of next week. And you heard right, it's only £5 at 7:30. And we have another performance for you next. A few shows ago, I played the story of The Lost Camel, a Rumi poem translated and adapted by Coleman Barks. I had several encouraging comments about that, and I thought it would be fitting to play another track from the album. Coleman Barks made this album with David Darling. It's called Just Being Here. It's a good album, even if you judge it only by quantity. It comes to, well, over 2.5 hours, containing 15 poems or stories. Here's a story about a Sufi outcast, but an unusual one, since the man was a sheikh, a man of some importance. But his holy works and his disregard for respectable behavior, especially about money, threw him deeply in debt and made him an outcast. Some might call him a sponger in Whitman's term, but if we accept him and come to his meal, we'll see what happens. It will confound your expectations.
Weep for the friend you will never know. Crying out in grief is necessary for the great opening into joy. Weep and feel the waves of grace rising. Here is a story about that necessity. Sheikh Ahmad was continually in debt. He borrowed great sums from the wealthy and gave it to the poor dervishes. He built a Sufi community by borrowing, and God was always paying his debts, turning sand into flour for this generous friend. Muhammad said that there are always two angels praying in the market, one saying, Lord, give the wanderer help, and the other, Lord, give the miser a poison. Especially loud is the former prayer when the wanderer is a prodigal like Sheikh Ahmad the debtor. For years until his death, he scattered seed profusely. Even very near his death, with the signs clear, he sat surrounded by his creditors, the creditors in a circle, and the great sheikh in the center, gently melting into himself like a candle. The creditors were so sour-faced with worry, they could hardly breathe. Look at these despairing men, thought the sheikh. Do they think God does not have 400 gold dinars? Just at that moment, a boy outside called, "Halva, a sixth of a dirham for a piece, fresh halva." Sheikh Ahmad, with a nod of his head, directed the famulus to go and buy the whole tray of halva. Maybe if these men eat a little sweetness, they won't look so bitterly on me. The servant went to the boy. "How much for the entire lot?" "Half a dinar and some change." "Don't ask too much from Sufis, my son. Half a dinar is enough." The boy handed over the tray, and the servant brought it to the sheikh, who passed it around. "Please, eat and be happy, please." The tray was quickly emptied, and the boy asked the sheikh for half a gold dinar. "Where would I find such money? These men can tell you how in debt I am, and besides, I am fast on my way to non-existence." The boy threw the tray on the floor and started weeping and yelling, "I wish I had broken my legs before I came in here. I wish I had stayed in the bathhouse today. You gluttonous, plate-licking Sufis, washing your faces like cats." A crowd gathered. The boy continued, "My master will beat me if I come back without anything." The creditors joined in. "How could you do this? You have devoured our properties, and now you add this one last debt before you die. Why?" The sheikh closes his eyes and does not answer. The boy weeps until afternoon prayers. The sheikh withdraws under his coverlet, pleased with everything, pleased with eternity, pleased with death, and totally unconcerned with all the reviling talk around him. On a bright moon night, do you think the moon, cruising through the 10th house, can hear the dogs barking down here? But the dogs are doing what they are supposed to do. Water does not lose its purity because of a bit of weed floating in it. The king drinks wine on the riverbank until dawn, listening to the water music, not hearing the frog talk. The money due the boy would have been just a few pennies from each of the creditors, but the sheikh's spiritual power prevents that from happening. No one gives the boy anything. After the afternoon prayers, a servant comes from Hatim, a friend of Ahmad's, and a man of great wealth, a covered tray. Ahmad uncovers the face of the tray, and on it, There are 400 gold dinars. And in one corner, half a dinar wrapped in a piece of paper. Immediately the cries of abasement. King of Sheikhs, Lord of the Lords of Mystery, forgive us. We were bumbling and crazed, knocking over lamps. It is all right. You will not be held responsible for what you said or did or didn't do. The secret here is that I asked, and the way was shown that not until the boy's weeping could God's generosity be loosened. Let the boy be like the pupil of your eye. If you want to wear a robe of spiritual sovereignty, let your eyes weep with the wanting. One ascetic once to another, you should not cry so much, you will injure your eyes. The other replies, tears are not the problem. Either one sees the holy light around existence, or one doesn't. If you see, what is there to grieve about? If you don't, you may as well cry your eyes blind. Ask the spirit within for help. That is who Jesus is. The Jesus of your soul is within you now. Ask for your sight to be healed. When you know that presence, there will be no sadness. Don't ask for body comforts. The body is a tent or a boat, which is nothing until you live and move inside it. Then it glows with presence. Don't ask Moses for provisions you can get from Pharaoh. Don't worry so much about livelihood. Your livelihood will go as it should. Be constantly occupied instead with listening to God.
So, good night, and thanks for attending Evening Under Lamplight with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105. Write to me at rlamomentsunderlamplight.com. Hear the archives in the Evening Under Lamplight section at momentsunderlamplight.com. We'll end with Leonard Cohen giving us the Outcasts' plea, "Please Don't Pass Me By," from his live 1973 album. It's a kind of tour de force of self-laceration and a kind of willing abandonment of any dignity. But the singing becomes a kind of kirtan chant, lifting everyone to a whole other level. The whole thing lasts over 15 minutes, but we'll cut out before that. And it's good to end our show this way, weird as usual. "I heard your show the other day," Trevor Dan said to me recently. "It's weird." So let's go out weird once more. "Please Don't Pass Me By," subtitled "A Disgrace."
I was walking in New York City and I brushed up against a man in front of me. I felt a cardboard placard on his back. And when we passed a streetlight, I could read it. It said, "Please don't pass me by. I am blind, but you can see. I've been blinded totally. Please don't pass me by. I was walking along 7th Avenue. When I came to 14th Street, I saw in the corner curious mutilations of the human form. It was a school for handicapped people, and there were cripples and people in wheelchairs and crutches, and it was snowing, and I got this sense that the whole city was singing this. Oh, please don't pass me by. I was walking, I thought it was them who were singing it. I thought it was they who were singing it. I thought it was the other who was singing it. I thought it was someone else, but as I moved along, I knew it was me and that I was singing it myself. It went, please don't pass me by. Sitting there deep in your velvet seats, and you're thinking he's up there saying something that he thinks about, but I'll never have to sing that song. But I promise your friends that you're going to be singing this song. May not be tonight, may not be tomorrow, but one day you'll be on your knees, and I want you to know the words. When the time comes, 'cause you're gonna have to sing it to yourself, or to another, or to your brother. You're gonna have to learn how to sing this song. It goes, please don't pass me by. Oh, you don't have to sing this, not for you. Gypsies and the smoke that they made. And I sing this for the children of England, their faces so grave. And I sing this for a savior with no one to save. Hey, won't you be naked for me? Hey, won't you be naked for me? It goes, please don't pass me by.